Hello, Absurdistanis, and welcome to Absurdistan, the transatlantic political podcast with news and opinion from the absurd political reality which is our home. My name is John.
And my name is Adam.
This week we'll be discussing the Democratic congressional primary upset of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez over incumbent Joe Crowley, and the recent Supreme Court decision regarding President Donald Trump's travel ban. All that and your weekly look ahead coming up, but first, Adam, how are you?
I'm doing really well this week, because my thesis is done. The thesis is completely done, so I feel almost like a free man. I've got one more paper to go, but, you know, I'm 3 days from leaving Spain, and the degree ended well, so yeah, I'm flying high. I'm doing well.
So next is applications to doctorate programs?
Next is heading home for a year to find work.
Oh, right.
Just for a little while. I'm quite happy to be going back to Scotland to take a break. We've got some stuff in the family going on as well, all good news, but nonetheless, we'll be heading back to Scotland for a little while, which will be nice.
And then you're coming to the States to visit me, so I'm happy about that.
Yeah, that's the hope. Traveling all summer will be good.
Speaking of the States, actually, both our stories this week are coming from the U.S.
Yeah, we're quite American-centric this week. I've been really interested in the dynamic of American politics as much as European politics. And so I've been keeping an eye on some of the primaries that have been happening in the lead-up to the midterms that will be coming in November. And there was a really significant one this week to come in New York, where, as you say, there was a major upset, a proper upset, where 28-year-old Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has defeated a 10-term congressman, Joseph Crowley, who was the 56-year-old chair of the House Democratic Caucus. So this guy was up there. He was a prospective future Democratic leader, if not a prospective Speaker of the House.
He had actually self-proclaimed himself as destined to take Nancy Pelosi's spot.
Wow. Okay. Well, it makes sense given that the district he's running in is quite heavily Democratic. And it also makes sense that, you know, for the past 14 years, he hasn't faced a primary challenge either. So the possibility that a, you know, a 28-year-old girl, you know, even from our perspective, she's our age, which is incredible. Nonetheless, he effectively had no fear that he would actually reach that goal. And yet, just on Tuesday, he lost the primary race by a whopping 57.5% to 43.5%. Perhaps that's not whopping, but it's a clear 15% margin.
That's a decisive victory when it comes to an election.
It's quite a decisive. You couldn't call it close. So now Ocasio-Cortez will be facing Republican Anthony Pappas in the November midterm. She's likely a shoo-in because of the district demographics and the way that it's voted over the last 20, 30 odd years. And she's, because of that, likely going to be the youngest ever woman elected to Congress.
That's right.
Which is quite an impressive feat and should be noted. She's considered part of the pink wave, which is this incredible rise in the number of female candidates that are running for Congress, possibly in response to Trump. If you read some of the articles that some of the opinion pieces about why this is happening, a lot of it goes back to the language that Trump used in his campaign to describe women and his interactions with women and his history with women.
Right.
And so she's part of this movement. And she's coming out of this congressional district. This is New York's 14th. It's in New York City and it's split between the East Bronx and North Queens. And it's demographically very diverse. It's predominantly a minority community, with only 18% being white and almost 50% being Hispanic. It's very democratic, and it's one of the top 40 most partisan districts of the 435 that exist in the United States, and that's including both Republican and Democratic districts. Incumbent Joe Crowley is a long-serving Democrat. He's served as a representative for New York in a couple districts for about 20 years or so. And as I said, he was tipped to be the future leader.
Crowley was a veteran Democrat in the House, and like you said, he was potentially going to be the future party leader, if not even the Speaker of the House. So he had a long-standing relationship with the Democratic establishment, and he had the support of the Democratic establishment, which is important. I think this election sort of came as a blindside to the political establishment in the Democratic Party, and they had no idea that this was going to happen. They fully expected Crowley to win and to win convincingly.
Which makes sense, but at the same time, you know, there haven't actually been too many progressive candidates elected so far in the primaries. And, you know, when you look at Ocasio-Cortez, she is one of the more progressive of the progressive candidates. But she's also one of the more, or I should say, less well-known. Gizmodo pointed out that she didn't even have a Wikipedia page up until last week. It's unsurprising that the Democratic establishment wouldn't have backed her anyway because she's an outside nobody, effectively. But that makes her accomplishment all the more profound. She's a Hispanic woman, and she's been an organizer on Bernie Sanders' campaign back in 2016.
That's right.
She's also a member of the Democratic Socialists of America, which I don't even know. Are they their own political
party? They're their own political party. Yeah, they don't have a whole lot of influence, but they are a party.
But she ran as a Democrat anyway.
Yeah, well, you've seen that happen with Bernie Sanders, for instance. He was registered technically as an independent prior to the 2016 primary, but he switched to the Democratic ticket, and that was more than likely due to the fact that third-party candidates face an entirely uphill battle trying to get elected. And so to sort of co-opt the existing structure within a party that's ostensibly ideologically aligned with you is a lot easier than building yourself from the ground up. So sort of trying to piggyback off of the established infrastructure and funding and name recognition of a larger party is easier than making the Democratic Socialists of America, you know, relevant.
That makes sense. And it certainly did work for Bernie Sanders. Like, arguably, he would have received almost zero media coverage had he not been a significant threat to Hillary Clinton's position.
There's a lot of similarities here with what Bernie Sanders did and what Ocasio-Cortez did. Bernie had almost no name recognition prior to the 2016 primary, and he was going up against Hillary Clinton, who is probably one of the best well-known politicians, not only in the United States, but on the planet. So to go from being an unknown senator from Vermont to all of a sudden capturing 44% and I think 23 states in the Democratic primary with no large corporate funding really to speak of, no super PACs, really riding off of on the backs of small donations. The average donation to Bernie Sanders' campaign was $27, which is similar to what Ocasio-Cortez did. But to build his name up, not even prior to the primary, but during the primary against one of the biggest political juggernauts of our time, this is sort of analogous to what happened that we're seeing this week with Ocasio-Cortez. No name recognition whatsoever. Like you said, the media barely reported on her whatsoever, maybe a mention here and there, but never an in-depth analysis of her candidacy. She had very little funding compared to Joe Crowley. I think Crowley raised over $3.1 million, and she raised just over $300,000. She only spent, I think, like $190,000 in her entire campaign, and she won by, what was it, 14%?
15%.
15%. It's crazy. It just shows you, I think, the extent to which people distrust the political establishment in this country and the extent to which populism resonates, I think, with the voting public.
Would you call her a populist or just a social democrat?
Well, I would say that social democratic values play more towards the populist feelings.
Maybe in the States, because in Europe, it's the social democrats that are taking the hit as the populists rise.
That's true, because
they're the establishment.
Well, exactly, because somebody like Ocasio-Cortez, somebody like Bernie, we've spoken before with the Overton window in the United States, where you have a Bernie Sanders-like character whose policies, really, if you look at the international stage, are fairly centrist. Nobody in Europe or even the UK is going to bat an eyelash when you talk about single-payer healthcare systems, for instance, or even socialized medicine like you have in the UK, or even in many states, funding for education, funding for college education. These are not overly controversial viewpoints, where in the United States they're considered far left. So I think the populist notion in the United States hovers more around the international centrism that we're talking about, and that's never been mainstream in the United States, whereas that's typically been mainstream in Europe, which is why populists in Europe, like Jeremy Corbyn, for instance, if you could characterize him almost as one, runs far to the left of the normal or accepted establishment of this social democracy that you see in Europe.
Because I would have said that populism in the States in particular is a right-wing phenomenon, not as much a left-wing phenomenon. And Corbyn, is Corbyn a populist? I don't think I would characterize Corbyn as a populist. I would just characterize him as a...
He's a socialist. He's a straight-up socialist. He's not a democratic socialist.
He's a socialist.
He would... I mean, he's praised, you know, Chavez in Venezuela and even in some...
Castro in Cuba.
Oh, he praised Castro as a defender of social justice, which... Yeah. was an incredibly misguided statement as far as I'm concerned. But You're right that populism in the United States, there is a right-wing populism. But if you look at the support that Trump had, a lot of his policies were actually fairly liberal in their base. I mean, he repeatedly came out and talked about how we should regulate drug prices and that we should have Medicare for all. He praised the medical system in Scotland, which is a universal healthcare system. Mm-hmm. He talked about protectionism and protecting American jobs and resisting globalism, which has long been a left-leaning policy in the United States, where you have imposing stricter tariffs and prioritizing the worker in the United States, which Trump claimed to want to do. He wanted to stop Carrier from exploiting the jobs and all these things that he hasn't really come through on at all. But these promises were kind of from a worker-based, small, little people-based platform. So while, yes, it did sweep to power the Republicans, the actual meat of what he campaigned on, if you really dig down into the policy substance, other than obviously his xenophobia and racism and sexism, whatever you want to call it, a lot of his policy positions that he campaigned on are traditionally left-leaning policies. In all campaigns, you have what people campaign on and what they actually do. During his campaign, the reason that Trump didn't have the widespread support of the Republican Party is because he broke with the Republican Party on many different things. He wanted to expand Social Security, not cut it. He wanted to get out of these useless wars that were just killing American civilians and were expending billions of dollars nation building when we should be focusing on infrastructure. Infrastructure has always been a left-leaning policy in the United States since FDR with his New Deal. So he had almost the perfect mix of economic populism, but then also this xenophobia, this fear-mongering, essentially, that played to people's most primal fears about the stature of the United States and the world. I think that's why he was successful. So you're right that there is a right-wing populism, but I also think that when you talk about the populist policies that you see in the United States, a lot of times they're worker-centric, people-centric, and lean further to the left.
Well, and it certainly would be the case for Ocasio-Cortez. She ran a campaign essentially based on those goals, those values. Her entire platform effectively fit with the Bernie model. So, as you say, universal healthcare, specifically Medicare for all, tuition-free public colleges, criminal justice reform, even the abolition of the ICE, the Immigration Customs Enforcement.
That's right.
And that was, you know, obviously these types of programs would have fit well with the demographic nature of her congressional district. And she was backed by a number of grassroots movements that also back these platforms. So MoveOn.org, the Justice Democrats, Black Lives Matter, and of course the People for Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, Our Revolution as well, yeah.
Yeah, so all left-leaning, all progressive.
Right.
And as you said earlier, she just did not have the support of the establishment. And I was really interested by this one because notably she didn't receive the support of Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, who actually runs an action committee trying to aid female candidates win United States federal offices. But she ended up endorsing Crowley, even though there is a female Democrat on the progressive side, which supposedly Gillibrand is, you know, kind of bigging up herself as she is considered one of the current favorites for the candidacy for the Democratic ballot in the 2020 presidential election. And so it was just strange because, you know, here she has effectively her perfect candidate, and yet she's backing Crowley, who's fully attached to the money, like the finances of his campaign. As you said, he'd raised $3.3 million. Most of that came from, about 30% came from large individual donors, and another 40% came from PACs. Whereas Ocasio-Cortez raised $300,000, and 75% of her support came from small individual donors. Not only do the finances effectively work in Ocasio-Cortez's favor, but she is progressive, she is female, and so you would expect someone like Kirsten Gillibrand to be all over an endorsement for her. So why do you think not? Is it just that she was too far left? Is she just too much of an unknown? Is it the Democrats playing it too safe?
Well, I think there's a certain amount of hubris in the Democratic establishment.
But you'd think they'd have learned from, like, Georgia 8, for instance. What was his name? Ossoff. They put up Ossoff as a candidate, and he completely failed. He was a buttermilk wealthy guy.
Well, I mean, you'd like to think that, but I mean, what has the Democratic Party really learned after the 2016 election?
But you would expect them to learn something by now. So, like, I would be okay. Like, I am fine with the idea that they put Clinton up against Trump. I think it was their best bet. I'm not convinced that Bernie would have won. You would like to think that the Democrats would like to maintain their position as kind of the more sensible party, at least from my perspective, perhaps a more stable party. So, in other words, to go with more extreme candidates in the same way that the Republicans have in the past, so like Tea Partiers, for instance. You know, it just doesn't make sense for them to run out to the Bernie side of the party when centrism tends to win in the States. Like, primaries, as we know, tend to create more extreme candidates that are more difficult to convince the opposite side to kind of cross the aisle, cross the divide. So doesn't it make sense that Democrats should endorse the more centrist candidates that can kind of attract moderate Republicans, especially in the age of Trump?
I don't think that they should be overly concerned with flipping voters, because if you look at the most recent election, the Democrats had the popular vote. They lost because of the electoral election. They lost effectively because Hillary Clinton didn't appeal to workers in places like Pennsylvania and Michigan. Pennsylvania being a state which is surprising that it went to Trump, for instance. Mm-hmm. So what made her lose the election was a couple thousand votes here and there in some really key states. So what you need to do is motivate Democrats to come out and vote. And the way that you do that is by appealing to your Democratic base. I don't think the problem is in Democrats convincing Republicans to vote for the Democratic Party. I think it's the exact opposite. I think it's all too easy for Republicans to switch Democrats. You saw this in the prior election where people who voted for Obama twice flipped and voted for Trump because they saw the Democratic Party at having abandoned their base. They don't need to flip Republicans. What they need to do is gain back the votes of Democrats.
But I think in general, though, the Bernie candidates aren't getting the same success, level of success as the primaries go on, as perhaps they would have liked. And I think that's okay. I wonder if a better strategy is perhaps to almost divide and conquer, in a sense, and that in those districts that are very likely to go Democratic, you should have implemented or have endorsed the more left-wing candidates so that at least you can have the left-wing voice in Congress. Even if they're not, you know, necessarily going to be a big group. You know, they'll still vote Democrat, they'll still caucus with the Democrats, but you still get to have that left-wing voice in the body of the legislative body itself. Whereas in districts that are far more likely to swing running centrist candidates, which means that it would be more advantageous for Bernie candidates or Bernie supporters to support endorsed establishment Democrats.
Really what I see being the problem is that there are certain red states that I don't think are worthy of trying to go after to switch, to be honest. And there are other states like Massachusetts. I would say the same thing about Republicans in states like Massachusetts and New York. Why even bother? You need to focus on these states that are in the middle or teetering around the middle that have large electoral consequence. Something that Hillary Clinton just didn't do. Like, she didn't even visit Michigan once during the general campaign. And surprise, surprise, she lost it. She lost it, a state in which Bernie trounced her in the primary, by the way. So while you're right that, you know, if you're running in a primarily red district, you're probably not going to be successful with your left-wing message. But I don't think it's as important to win those districts because it's not probable that you're going to. So why not still campaign to the left and get your message out there, knowing full well you're still going to lose. You're still going to lose that district. But really, really focus on the districts that you lost that lost you the election.
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is a breath of fresh air. She represents a series of values that I personally agree with. My worry is that it's just not a set of values that are readily palatable for the majority of Americans, but maybe that's not what she's there to do. I think she's going to be more of a candidate that kind of adds a bit of pressure to begin to slide that Overton window out to the left in the state. So good on her. As a 28-year-old female Hispanic woman who's likely going to win her district, Ocasio-Cortez provides a perspective in the Legislative Assembly that has never existed before. And for that alone, her potential victory is welcome. As it's June, this is the time of year that the Supreme Court of the United States hands down a number of decisions, and this week there were a fair few important ones. One of the more important decisions to come out this week was the Supreme Court's decision regarding Trump's Muslim ban, quote-unquote, or rather, Trump versus Hawaii. John, I know that you wanted to cover this story.
That's right, Adam. This week, the Supreme Court upheld the Presidential Proclamation number 9645, which is better known as President Trump's travel ban. Some have called it a Muslim ban. I actually spent the day reading the entire opinion, taking notes, and developing my notes in the interest of being factually accurate and bringing you the nuances of the case that you might not get from other news outlets. So the decision was 5-4, and as expected, it was split along party lines. Chief Justice Roberts wrote the opinion, and he was joined by Kennedy, Thomas, Alito, and Gorsuch in the majority, and Breyer, Kagan, Sotomayor, and Ginsburg were in the dissent, which is to be expected. Breyer wrote his own dissent, and Sotomayor wrote her own dissent. Kagan and Ginsburg joined, respectively. When you hear Muslim ban and travel ban, these phrases and the way that we talk about what's going ahead of the Supreme Court, they tend to be sensationalized by the media into these large issues, and they tend to like to ascribe motives behind the case and focus on the drama. But the Supreme Court generally will really narrow the focus of these things to legal precedents and whether they have standing to sue, whether or not there is an injury that needs to be addressed constitutionally. And so these opinions are generally rather dry. They have a lot of cross-references to prior opinions and legal precedent, and they focus squarely on the legal issues at hand, and they tend not to bring in any of the drama outside of it. And that's what we see in this case. In the majority opinion, they saw essentially two main arguments that were coming from the plaintiffs in this case, that being Hawaii suing the Trump administration. Number one was that Trump violated sections 1182F and 1152A1A of the Immigration and Nationality Act. Now, this is an act set forth by Congress that governs the rules as far as how visas are given to immigrants and non-immigrants and what laws govern those, and then also what authority the president has when it comes to visas and immigration.
And those are the things that are specific within those two sections of the act.
That's correct.
In other words, do you know the specifics of what each section of that act pertain to?
I do, and we'll get to that in a minute, but I just wanted to give the overall span of the case, and then we'll get into that in further detail later. The second issue brought by plaintiffs was that Trump violated the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment by singling out the religious identity of these immigrants. And this was more of an inference from his statements that on the campaign trail and statements even after the campaign trail, things that were listed on his website, for instance. These were also referred to in amicus briefs that seemed to point towards the fact that it was essentially what they were trying to prove in our episode that we had with Chris Gavrilides, where we're talking about piercing the veil into the actual motivations behind an action. So the face of the action might seem legal in every sense of the word, but the motivations behind it are for unconstitutional or unlawful means. So essentially what these plaintiffs were trying to do was to pierce that veil and say, well, yeah, on its face, it's a completely legal thing for the president to do. Or even if it is a completely legal thing for the president to do, which they argued it wasn't, even if it was, it violated the Establishment Clause, or the intention was to violate the Establishment Clause. By way of background on this order, originally Trump signed an executive order halting immigration from seven countries, as you'll remember: Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen. These were all countries that had been previously identified by Congress and prior administrations, including the Obama administration, as posing a heightened terrorism risk. Shortly after this was signed, the District Court for the Western District of D.C. blocked this order. So rather than really pursuing that through the courts, Trump rescinded that. He revoked that original order and replaced it with an order targeting immigration from Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen, citing that these states had state sponsorship of terrorism, or they had active conflict zones in these countries that posed national security threat to the United States. Originally, these restrictions were in place for 90 days, while the Department of Homeland Security was tasked with conducting a worldwide review of the systems that other governments had for sharing their information about their nationals who wanted to immigrate to the United States. The second executive order was challenged in the district courts of Maryland and Hawaii, and both courts placed preliminary injunctions on the ban. On September 24th, 2017, President Trump issued Presidential Proclamation 9645. Now, this proclamation was based on this worldwide review that was commissioned by the president for the DHS. The DHS examined all nations that it could in light of an established baseline of three parts. And this is all in the established facts in the Supreme Court opinion. Number one, they were examining the identity management information that was provided by other governments, including the integrity of travel documents like passports and things like that. Then they examined the extent of the disclosure of criminal history and terrorist links that were given to us by these other nations. And lastly, they reviewed national security concerns. So if there were active terrorist cells operating within the country, for instance, or there were active conflict zones. Based on these three criteria, the DHS identified 16 states that did not sufficiently meet this criteria. And they noted an additional 31 nations that were at risk of violating these baseline criteria that they had set forth. So once that determination was made, the State Department took on a 50-day diplomatic campaign in which they encouraged these nations that were found to be on this list to further clarify their operations and how they would provide information to the United States. And after this 50 days, the DHS whittled that list down to 8 countries that did not meet these criteria, down to Iran, Iraq, Libya, North Korea, Syria, Venezuela, and Yemen. The secretary of the DHS recommended removing Iraq because of their commitment to fighting ISIS and also because of the strong diplomatic relations that we have with them. And they suggested to add Somalia because even though they did meet these criteria technically, there were still some concerns about terrorist activity in the nation. So importantly, this order put in a 180-day review process. So after 180 days, it would be reviewed again, and then if these nations had fixed the problems that were identified by the Department of Homeland Security, they could have these requirements lifted. And this actually did happen. After the first review period, Trump lifted the ban on, I think, the nation of Chad and possibly Sudan, I think.
Yeah, I remember Chad being randomly included on this for seemingly no reason.
He did lift the requirements on Chad, for instance. This entire proclamation was 12 pages. And it included waivers for certain conditions, like student visas, for instance. And it also mostly affected immigrant visas and not non-immigrant visas. So these were to be, you know, permanent residencies in the United States, those sorts of visas. So other visas for students, for really important business trips, for instance, those were allowed on a case-by-case basis. So it was more of an individualized ban, or it was called a more individualized ban than a blanket stop of immigration from these countries. So this challenge eventually came to the Supreme Court. They relieved the injunction until they could actually hear the oral arguments, and they did, and they handed down their opinion this week.
There was also an issue, I remember, during the first iteration of the ban that even green card holders would have been stopped at the border. Was that included in the most up-to-date version of the ban?
Yeah, there was a waiver for green card holders.
Because that I would have significant issue with. But okay, continue.
So in the opinion of the court, they examined the arguments of the plaintiffs regarding specifically Section 1182F of the Immigration and Nationality Act and Section 1152A1A. So the text under question for 1182F is, quote, whenever the president finds that entry of any aliens or class of aliens in the United States would be detrimental to the interests of the United States, he may, by proclamation, and for such period as he shall deem necessary, suspend the entry of all aliens or any class of aliens as immigrants or non-immigrants, or impose on the entry of aliens any restriction he deemed to be appropriate.
Hmm. That sounds like quite a wide-ranging power.
And that is how the court interpreted it. The state tried to argue that a suspension that's listed there in the section of the act refers to something that is necessarily short term. It's not a permanent sort of arrangement. And the proclamation that the Trump administration put forward essentially ignored this and put no time limit on these restrictions. But in response to that, the court cited prior proclamations by President Clinton, Reagan, Carter, and even Obama, which limited entry from specific nations. And those proclamations, out of 43 suspensions of immigration from other nations prior to a proclamation 9645 by President Trump, there was no precise end date in any of these prior 43 suspensions. They were all based off of certain diplomatic things that happened. With Obama, it was over the Crimea situation. For instance, he prohibited entry by certain Russians into the United States. And that was not going to be lifted until the situation was resolved. So if the situation had not been resolved, then it would have been a long-standing order.
It seems then that the court is using the precedent of presidential acts to then set the precedent for what they should be in the future. The vagueness of the Constitution and presumably the legislation following it was seemingly vague so that, you know, these previous presidents from Carter through to Obama could use their powers in this way as they wanted. But isn't it kind of unusual for the court to say, well, because previous presidents did do it, then now that we're ruling on it, we're going to agree that that it was a good thing. In other words, they could have taken the opportunity to say, no, we are setting the judicial precedent as opposed to the executive precedent. It's just odd for me to see them use precedent from another branch of government.
Well, I think the difference is that in this case, in the first part of the opinion, they were addressing whether or not the president had violated the act of Congress. This isn't a constitutional matter, the first few sections of this of this opinion. It was more of a review of the legality based on the text of the act of Congress. This wasn't on a constitutional text. The constitutional argument comes later when we talk about the Establishment Clause and the First Amendment specifically.
Okay, sure.
Also, the court noted that Proclamation 9645 was the most comprehensive and detailed. For instance, the one that Clinton gave was one sentence. The one that Reagan gave was five sentences. So these were very short orders, but the ones that the Trump administration put into effect was 12 pages based on a review. And not only was it based on a review, but some nations had been taken off the list after this review had been done. So the court was hard-pressed to sort of say that this was not a comprehensive order that was based on some certain conditions, then if those conditions were met, then you could come off of that ban list. The second section of the Immigration and Nationality Act that was under question in this case was Section 1152A1A, which in part says, quote, no person shall be discriminated against in the issuance of an immigrant visa because of the person's race, sex, nationality, place of birth, or place of residence. So the state argued that there was a discrimination against certain individuals in the spirit of this proclamation, essentially talking about President Trump's rhetoric and saying, well, it's clear that this is what it was meant to do. This was the meaning of the proclamation, and he was acting contrary to what's allowed by the law. But in the opinion, the court noted that Section 1152 only applies to granting of visas and not actual entry of individuals, whereas Section 1182 refers to the entry. So the president can bar entry of anyone. You can actually get a visa, but not be allowed to enter the country. So you can't say to somebody because of their sex or their race or their nationality, you can't have a visa, but you can grant them the visa and then upon a review say, well, actually, we can't allow you into the country. And the president's proclamation is only really governed by 1182. And the court found that the language of 1182 was broad enough that it the court actually said, quote, it exudes a deference to the president and his authority to make a proclamation banning the travel of any of these individuals.
I love the technicalities of that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's very, very technical, and it very much ignores the context in which this was brought up by the president. And you see that actually specifically the court refers to that. The court ruled that the order was neutral on its face in its application. So there was really no technical legal discrimination that was being done. It was neutral on its face and it served the purpose of protecting national interest. Also important to the court was that it allowed waivers of the order and that apparently these order waivers were taking place in countries like Chad, for instance, that was taken off the list. It did not only affect nations of a Muslim majority. For instance, you had Venezuela and North Korea. Although, interestingly enough, the states didn't challenge the ban on travel from North Korea and Venezuela. They only did of these Islamic nations, specifically because they were arguing that it was based off of an animus towards the Muslim faith.
Sure.
So Iraq and Sudan and Chad were actually removed from the original lists. And the court said, well, how can it be a Muslim ban if, you know, a country with by far majority Muslims, Iraq, for instance, was taken off the list? And they actually referenced a case called Kleindienst v. Mandel, and they quoted the opinion in that court that says, quote, when the executive exercises this delegated power, and this delegated power in this case was banning people from coming from other nations, for instance, on the basis of a facially legitimate and bona fide reason, this would be something that's neutral on its face, so a neutral order on its face, the courts will neither look behind the exercise of that discretion nor test it by balancing its justification. So this is Supreme Court precedent where if the executive acts in a lawful way that is neutral on its face, it will not consider the motivations behind that, even if they're politically motivated.
Hmm. Fascinating. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And so ultimately what they decided was that because of the fact that this proclamation was neutral on its face, they could not then overturn it because of Trump's campaign statements, because of the arguments that we cited prior where some Muslim majority nations were not included on the list. Some came off of it. There were waivers for this program in it. And because of these waivers, some states were actually taken off the list. So the Supreme Court found that it's neutral in its application. So therefore, by legal precedent, we don't probe further and examine the justification behind it. We just need to rule whether or not the application of it is actually constitutionally allowed. And that's where the court ultimately came down. So they sided with the Trump administration on this case, and then they actually remanded it for further litigation in the district court. So if the district court wants to actually taking a look at the justification behind it and finding whether or not it's being neutrally applied, that's allowed. But the Supreme Court deferred to the president's power and essentially knocked down the arguments that specifically sections 1182 and 1152 of the Immigration and Nationality Act and the Establishment Clause of the Constitution were being violated.
So I haven't gone through the detail. I actually think it was a fairly good decision then. So I'm interested to know what the dissension was. Why would the other four justices contradict the opinion?
So Breyer wrote the first dissent, and what he argued was that in order for this ruling to be correct, there would have to be some verification that these waiver systems that are being used are being applied neutrally. Not only does the act have to be neutral on its face, it also has to be applied neutrally. So essentially what his argument was is that it appears that it's really neutral in name only, and that the waivers are nominal only. So for instance, only 2% of visa applications after Trump's travel ban have been approved. And these are even visa applications that are in any other case would be eligible for the waiver are being denied. There was a case actually that was brought up in an amicus brief to the court. So these aren't legal fact findings, for instance, because they're not brought in the case itself, but you can file an amicus brief to the court and basically argue to the court on behalf of the plaintiff or the defendant why you think the court should find in a certain way. And you see various rights groups do this all the time. Some unions do it. Like the ACLJ, the ACLU, legal institutions like that will put forth amicus briefs to the court. So in one case, in an amicus brief, there was a case in Yemen where there was a young person who had cerebral palsy, and they were applying for a visa waiver to the United States because the war in Yemen had actually made it impossible for them to have access to their medication, and they actually could no longer talk or move or anything. It was a very tragic case. And they were denied. They could be reasonably expected to receive a waiver. After this case was cited in an amicus brief put before the court, suddenly the administration reversed course and said, oh, well, actually, it's being reconsidered and a supervisor hadn't approved it. There was also testimony in amicus briefs by several people who worked for U.S. embassies, for instance, that were in charge of reviewing visa applications, that in practice, they weren't allowed to act upon these waivers or grant waivers. So there is a fair amount of evidence that these waivers are not being applied neutrally. And I think only 430 people since the program took effect have actually been granted waivers. So it's a very small percentage of people who are seeking these waivers that are otherwise eligible for these waivers that are not receiving them. So that was Breyer's dissent. And he thought that this should be something that's considered. So the court should take a look at whether or not it's actually being applied neutrally. Sotomayor was a little bit more barbed in her dissent. You could tell that she had disdain for the holding of the court. And essentially what she focused on was Trump's statements in the campaign, where he specifically called it a Muslim ban, and he called for a complete and total shutdown of Muslim immigration to the United States. Such statement was actually on Trump's website until May 2017, when it was brought down because of the controversy surrounding his Muslim ban. She brought attention to the statements that he's made. He's repeatedly talked about his travel bans being watered down versions of his original orders and that it's only being done for politically correct reasons. You had Trump's lawyer who has said essentially once his first Muslim ban was struck down, he called this lawyer and said, how do I do this legally? How do I do it in a politically correct way that's going to essentially be allowed through the courts? So there's a lot of circumstantial evidence in which there is a definite animus towards Muslim immigration into the United States by the administration. And that's what Sotomayor was focusing on. And interestingly enough, I thought the most salient point of Sotomayor's dissent, because she did mention a lot of things that were outside of the scope of the fact findings of the case. But something that she did bring up was a recent decision regarding Masterpiece Cake Shop. She made a very interesting connection here, which I agree with. We talked about this with Chris Gavrilides, and if you remember, one of the things on which the case turned was the fact that the Civil Rights Commission in Colorado had shown distinct hostility towards the religious beliefs of the Baker, you know, calling them outdated and horrible beliefs, essentially. Those were just a few statements, right? And what the court did was that they found it was wrong for the state to discriminate against him because of the open hostility in which they showed to him and his religious beliefs. And Sotomayor focused on the fact that, hey, you decided that way in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case. You said that if there's open hostility of the government, then you can judge the government's motivations for making rules and regulations or enforcing rules and regulations against a specific religious group. But you're completely fine with ignoring the motivations behind Trump. Essentially what the court did here, and I think I've seen it said, and I think it's an accurate representation, having read the decision in full, what they're doing is they're separating the president from the presidency itself, and they're focusing entirely on the rights of the presidency and what the president is allowed to do, and not necessarily on who is president and why they're doing it. So the controversial nature of Trump really wasn't considered at all, or considered to be legitimate enough to call into question the constitutionality of the order.
Upon hearing the evidence myself, I would say that the Supreme Court got it right down the line, though. I'd say it was a good decision. Given that there's this stipulation to check, well, given lower courts the discretion to check the actual application of the waiver program, I think they've more or less got it right down the middle. Largely because the states that are included, so the countries that are included in this, are actual legitimate threats to the interests of the United States. And if it were a Muslim ban, you know, there are six countries ultimately included in this, when there are a vast number and a huge number of people in a number of different countries that still have access to the visa program. Like all of North Africa, most of the Middle East, the Southeast Asian countries, Indonesia is the biggest Muslim country in the world, not included. Malaysia, Jordan, Lebanon, you know, Algeria, Tunisia, Morocco, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Oman, like, so you can keep on going. There's a huge, vast number of countries, and the majority of the Muslim world still perfectly able and legally allowed to both enter and apply for visas to the United States. When it comes to Sotomayor's specific dissent, I think she's too ready to assume that the motivation that's behind the Muslim ban is one that is religiously motivated and not politically motivated. So in other words, I could easily see a world in which Trump has pursued this type of policy on the basis of what we know is inflated rhetoric, so as to appease his voters and say, look, I have given you the Muslim ban. And actually, at the same time, he's accomplished it by singling out the countries that are actually a threat to American national interests, without actually banning Muslims. So I don't necessarily see a problem with the logic in the ruling. I don't disagree. I can find no place in it where I can disagree.
I don't think Sotomayor is saying, well, this is an interreligious conflict and Trump is doing this because he is of a different religious persuasion. He's trying to put a Christian nation into effect. No, it doesn't matter if it's a political motivation. A political motivation can still violate the First Amendment, because the First Amendment protects individuals' rights to religion, and it prevents the state from applying laws specifically to a religious group.
Well, and this was one of the things I was going to ask you as well, bringing up the constitutional rights. At what point does the constitutional right of an individual start? How far into the system, quote unquote, does it apply as soon as you get through the border? Does it apply as soon as you walk into an American consulate? Does it, does it apply to me as a UK citizen living in Spain?
That's one of the interesting points about why the Supreme Court found that there was standing in this case for the people who brought the lawsuit. So if this had been visa applicants, for instance, I doubt that the Supreme Court would have said, yeah, we're going to grant you certiorari and you have standing in this case. What it was is there was, I think it was the University of Hawaii and three Muslim individuals in Hawaii who either were citizens of the United States or green card holders. And they had family members. These three individuals had family members who were denied visas because of this ban. Mm-hmm. So they claimed an irreparable harm and injury due to this proclamation because they were being separated from their family. And the Supreme Court essentially said that was particularized enough so that it could be parsed as those people being irreparably harmed by the proclamation. And also the university claimed that, oh, well, we're trying to attract the best talent from around the world. And if these visa programs are prohibiting us from considering candidates in other nations, then we're not going to necessarily get the best talent for our university. And that's what granted them standing. That's where the Supreme Court found standing, is because it's not necessarily that non-citizens were being discriminated on because of their religious identity. It was because citizens may have irreparable harm done to them by this proclamation because of the fact that the state is violating the First Amendment by denying their family members access to the United States.
But obviously not enough to actually overturn the ban.
Not enough to overturn the ban. And while they dressed it up in very sanitized legal jargon, this is yet another case, I think, where you can see a clear partisan split in the court, where you don't necessarily always get a 100% impartial court. There's certainly political leanings here. Again, like Sotomayor did say, and I think it is a good point, they're willing to give slightly different readings and slightly different importance to the motivations of government officials in different cases. So in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, I sincerely do think that if you're not going to take into account Trump's rhetoric on the Muslim ban and just applying a law or proclamation that's neutral at its face, fine, but apply that across the board. The Civil Rights Commission of Colorado, their laws are neutral on their face. You can't discriminate for whatever the basis of gender or sexuality. Just because the Civil Rights Commission then used fiery rhetoric in one case against this person, that was enough for the court to say, oh, well, they're putting undue pressure on his religious beliefs because of their motivations behind these laws. Clearly, there's an anti-religious, anti-Christian bias in this committee. So clearly, there's an anti-Muslim bias in the Trump administration just by looking at his repeated statements over and over again and his appointments of people with strong anti-Muslim bias. You can see that in his administration. But that's ignored by the court in this case and not in another case, which that's what frustrates me about it, is that if you're going to hold the standard that laws that are neutral on their face ought to be applied regardless of the justification behind it, then that should be what's held in every case. And that's where I disagree with the court here.
This is normally the section of the show where we bring you your weekly look ahead. I was going to be talking about the new Eritrea-Ethiopia peace accord. John was going to be bringing you some details about the upcoming Mexican election, as well as prison reform that's going through the Senate. But as we were recording this episode, we get some breaking news. We're recording on Wednesday in the early afternoon, Eastern Time. And we have just seen a breaking news alert come through that Justice Kennedy will be retiring from the Supreme Court, giving Donald Trump another opportunity to appoint a Supreme Court justice. This is quite significant because what it's likely to do, if he does end up appointing a proper conservative like Gorsuch, like his last appointment, it will shift the balance of the court from being a 4-4 left, right, and one largely swing vote in Kennedy to a proper 5-4 solid majority conservative. So all those 5-4 majorities with Kennedy as a swing vote, that could be a thing of the past. John, you look rather down. What do you have to say?
I guess what I would say at first is, Ruthie, baby.
Hold on.
You're looking old, you're looking frail, but keep eating that kale, keep working out, do whatever you need to do to at least make it to 2020. Kennedy was appointed by Ronald Reagan. He was expected to be sort of a conservative down the line, but he's morphed into the swing vote. In Obergefell v. Hodges, he sided with the majority, which held the constitutional right to gay marriage. He kind of bucked conservative orthodoxy by being one of the authors of the plurality opinion in Planned Parenthood v. Casey, which upheld the essential holding of Roe v. Wade. So he's been a mixed bag figure. Like, he is a conservative justice, but you can sort of argue him into being a swing vote, and he can fall on either side, especially when it comes to social issues. He tends to side more liberally. But Trump now has the opportunity to replace him with a more hardline conservative, like someone like Neil Gorsuch, where instead of having, you know, some of these splits come down on the side of the liberals, I guess, you could expect a 5-4 conservative majority for a long time. for a long time.
It fundamentally changes the outlook of American constitutional law for the next four decades or so. That's what we kind of estimated, given how young some of the other justices are.
Right. Roberts is fairly young. You have Thomas, who's getting up there, so he could be out soon. But if that happens while Trump's president, then it won't change much. But Gorsuch is, he's got another 30, 40 years on the bench. So you're talking long term, maybe three, four decades of conservative control of the court if Thomas falls in a certain way. Or if Ginsburg were to pass or to resign, you're talking, a 6-3 majority, which would be solid for a long time. Another thing is that I would expect, just off the bat here, I would expect him to try to fast track this and get it done before the midterms. Because as of right now, we saw the Republicans take the nuclear option in the Senate. So they would really only need a 50 plus one vote in the Senate at this point for the judicial confirmation. That's not hard to get. And if he was able to fast track this, get a nominee, and go through the Senate before the 2018 midterms, the election wouldn't even have any effect on the Supreme Court whatsoever.
Joy. So it looks as if we're in for a big change in American constitutional law.
That's a huge change. That's a huge, huge deal.
Because effectively, you could say that actually at the current state of the court, it is perfect. It's ideal. You have an equal justices that are both kind of ideologically aligned with one who's willing to take a stand on one side of the issue. So as you say, he was a conservative justice, but he's liberalized over the years.
Slightly. Well, so I wouldn't say it's perfect. I'm fine with the 4-4 split along ideological lines. That's okay. But I would prefer to see somebody who's more objective and neutral than a Kennedy. It's better now than I'm assuming it's going to be. Yeah.
I think it's an exciting time. I think I am excited not because I believe in the what I assume will be the eventual changes in the Supreme Court, but I like change. As someone who observes politics, change is interesting. And for this to be a change, even though it's going in the opposite direction, in a sense, it doesn't affect me, so I'm not as tied to it. I'm far more of a neutral observer than, say, John is, for instance, my not being an American citizen and all. I'm very much aware of the extent to which this will affect social laws and social rights over the next 30 or 40 years in the States. And so I am concerned for the views that I would hold, the more progressive views that I would hold. So given the importance of what's going to be happening in the United States, the opening of the Supreme Court, Kennedy's going to be standing down on July 31st, according to his resignation letter. So this is going to be the major look ahead story for the next few months. So it's definitely worth a watch. One of the other things that we're going to do in closing is to let you in on something a little closer to home. We're going to be starting next week a summer series. In true summer fashion, John and I are going to be traveling, so it's not going to be possible over the next 8 to 10 weeks that we're actually going to be able to sit down and record a quote-unquote live episode together. So what we've done is we've actually pre-recorded a bunch of episodes, and we're going to be starting a series on democracy, its problems, and its solutions. We'll be diving into the problems of representation, voting habits, the inflexibility of constitutions, the media, and postmodernism in a 5-part series. In true summer fashion, again, the series takes on a more informal, conversational tone as we just sit back and chat about some of our favourite political topics. It will kind of come at you randomly throughout the summer. Next week and the week after that will be part 1 and 2, and sometime in August we'll release part 3, 4, and 5. So we hope that you'll enjoy those episodes. They're worth watching out for. We really enjoyed recording them, and we think you'll enjoy them too.
And that's all we have time for today. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Absurdistanis. We're also on YouTube as Absurdistan with an exclamation point. Be sure to check out our website, absurdistanis.com. That's absurdistanis.com. We post all episodes to this website and also host forums for discussion so that you as the audience can engage with our content. Thanks for listening, and as always, stay informed.